podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson here, and it is the Anfield Wrap in association with Redsbet. And listen, we want to thank everyone who came to our shows that we did in Oslo and in Stockholm. Very, very good of them to come for those shows that we were doing with Redsbet over there. And I also thank everyone at Redsbet for their hospitality as well for the duration. The Scandinavians, my God, they want you to have a good time, and we very, very much did so. I'm going to just sort of leave you now and get on with this week's show. But this is the Anfield Wrap in association with Redsbet. It is the Anfield Wrap, Neil Atkinson. With us, we've got Neil Jones from the Liverpool Echo. First time he's been back on for a while, so really nice to see him. He's looking well. We're also joined by Fuad Hassan. It's his first show, so hello to Fuad and welcome. Hope he enjoys this. Paul Senior and Ian Ryan in. You get them all the time, but you get them all the time because they're good and they talk sense. So they're going to be talking about Southampton 0, Liverpool 2. And I'll go Neil Jones first on it, really, Neil. It was a game that I thought was just completely killed, completely finished by that brilliant second goal.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Jürgen Klopp was asked after the game about the timing of the two goals, and one early in the first half, one late in the second half, and I think his smile said it all. I think once that second goal went in, Southampton had had a little bit of a go. They'd had a lot of the ball and a couple of headed chances, and Karius had made a couple of saves, but as soon as Salah and Firmino combined, you didn't get the impression that they were a team capable of scoring two goals. And I think their fans gave up on them, and I think the players in the second half gave up on themselves.
What strikes me about that, Paul, was the extent to which they knew as soon as that second goal went in, you know, to then get it at half time, and yet it would be deflating, but you would think there'd be some sort of form of a rallying cry, we can get something out of this, we can do something here, lads. And the absolute opposite happened. It was such a dead game. They just went, yep, that's it then, we can't beat these.
Yeah, it's been a side that's been sort of struggling for goals for a while now. You know, they had a bit of a flurry when they brought Gabbiadini in, but really they've struggled without Charlie Austin. I was surprised actually, because I watched Southampton a few weeks ago against Tottenham, and they kept them at bay for a while, but both sides that day looked a little blunt. But you're absolutely right in what you're saying. Second goal killed them, and the fans did seem to give up on them. Second half was a non-contest.
Fuad, one of the things that struck me was the second goal. I think it's as much the nature of it as anything else. It was almost like this was a goal that Liverpool could score and Southampton couldn't score in the wildest dreams, with the quality, the back heel, the run, the finish. It isn't just that's it, we're 2-0 up. It's very much this is what you played quite well, but this is what our boys can do.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I was at the ground and couldn't really appreciate the quality of the back heel from up there in the stand. So, I mean, looking back at it, you just sort of see the technical ability. I mean, if that's Messi or any other sort of top quality player in Europe, I think that video would be doing rounds on Twitter and everyone would be going quite mental over it.
I think that's a brilliant... Sorry, Neil. I think that's a really brilliant point as well. For some reason, that you won't be seeing that goal for the rest of the season. In a way where... I always look at the overhead kick Rooney scores, and I think it's 2012 for Man United against Man City, and you see it forever. But some players will do that in, I don't know, a Southampton West Brom game, and you'll never see it again. And there's a sort of underestimation of this Liverpool side. I think it's because there's no stellar name. You know, even the way you hear that lads like Jack Wilshere spoken about still. Where if he's doing that, you know, he's seeing it on all the telly, everything for weeks and weeks and weeks. But it's almost just presumed these Liverpool lads will do it. And I think we need to keep enjoying it and almost have it almost like a little secret in a way. Everyone knows these are good. But sometimes when we do things that are that good, I just think it's a little bit underestimated.
I think it's something which I think I agree with both Paul and Fuad there, Ian, but it is something which, as I say, if you're playing for Southampton, you've had that pressure, you've had two or three good chances that we'll come on to talk about, and then that happens. And it is sort of Paul said before that if Austin doesn't play, they don't look like they've got a forward. I thought that Carrillo looks willing, looks like he's technically all right, you know, I wouldn't slag him off, but there's just this gulf, isn't there, between what Liverpool can do to you in the final third and what most sides in this league can.
I think you're absolutely right. And in terms of that second goal, as soon as it goes in, it reminded me of something like Romario and Stoichkov from that Barcelona team in like kind of the early to mid-90s, in terms of the invention, the class of it. And when something like that happens, if you're the opposition, I mean, you almost sense there was a collective sigh of this football match is no longer any of our business. I mean, the timing certainly plays a part because it's on 42 as well. And I think Pellegrino references that and says, you know, we felt we were kind of edging our way into the game. We've had some chances, as Neil's alluded to there. But then when something like that happens, when a moment of genius happens like that, and you've got two lads operating at the absolute peak of the powers, and they can just turn it on in an instant, it must be so disheartening if you're a Southampton player or a fan. And I think they just thought to themselves, there'll be other winnable games coming up for us. And they almost kind of, Neil, you always kind of reference this, kind of shook hands almost and thought, right, we'll take 2-0, we'll get out of here. Because the second half is an absolute non-event. It almost became like a training match for Liverpool. It was just absolutely no pressure at all. And it was a little bit surprising that Southampton didn't seem to kind of come out with any kind of rallying cry. I think when something like that happens, either two things will happen. You'll come out all guns blazing and try and get something, or as I said before, you will just almost kind of take it and say, right, this game's no longer any of our business. And that's what happened to Southampton.
The non-event thing is so true. I didn't go to the game yesterday, but I found myself almost not paying attention to it, because it had just become sort of background noise. Liverpool were fashioning chances and were maybe a little bit sloppy in front of goal second half. But you never felt like we were under real threat. And you see Van Dijk almost putting on like an exhibition. You know, look at me. And you can see the smirk on his face throughout the game, almost like, you want to know, you're booing me for coming here. This is why I'm here. It was like, I've proved my point in 65 minutes here. That my move is so much higher than this. We're in the same division, but we're not in the same league.
Go on, Neil.
I was going to say, I think the thing was as well, the second goal, they were 2-0 down. And they knew Liverpool hadn't played well, so they were like, God, they're going to have a moment where they're going to turn it on properly for 10 minutes. So what's going to happen then? We're going to have to go at them in the second half. They're going to mince us. It's basically what I think Southampton thought. They thought they could get beat 6 or 7 at home. Yeah. And I think they thought, you know what, I'll draw stumps here, we'll take 2-0, we'll try and hopefully nick one back in. I think at 1-0 you'd think they'll give us one, Liverpool, but at 2-0 you think we're just going to get opened up again.
There's two things on that, Neil, which again is why, you know, maybe take the sane option. The first thing that occurs to me is you're saying that they could have got done 6 or 7. One of the things that struck me whilst I was watching that second half was these sides at the bottom now, we're going to go on to play, a lot of them have got to start thinking about goal difference.
Yeah.
Because it's so, so tight. Definitely. You can throw a blanket over 10 teams at the minute, and you really can, and it's, yeah, you know, one result here and there, and there's now 11 games to go. It is a point. So if Liverpool do someone 6-0, 7-0, not just Liverpool, if Man City do it, someone gets done 7-0, it's like they lose a point.
And Liverpool are the team that can do it home or away as well. It's not going to Anfield and getting done 7. It's Liverpool coming to you and doing it to you, and it can happen. You know, Huddersfield got done 3, and
Brighton got done 5, Brighton, Bournemouth 4,
Stoke have been done 3,
yeah,
you know, West Ham have been done 4-1 was, yeah, it as well. So Liverpool are just, I think that the highest scorers now in the Europe's top 5 leagues away from home,
and really,
yeah, I think there was a graphic definitely put up in the Sky game, and they were either level or one behind, so they'll have done it. So yeah, that's the fear fact. I've always wanted Liverpool to have it, because I always felt United had it, where United got 3 games. Because teams would go into it, go, it doesn't matter what happens today, we're going to get beat. So if it's 2-0, let's have a handshake and say, well done. And I think Liverpool are not quite getting that, but they're certainly getting a degree of that about them.
It strikes me that if we can keep this record against these sides up, Paul, because I think the other thing we've got to sort of get rid of now is the myth of Liverpool always make a mess of it now against the smaller sides. Yeah. I think this season, I think there's a separate conversation, which is home draws, and that's when sides come and absolutely take the whole sting out of the football match. We have struggled with that, but that's its own thing. On the road, you know, yes, we get beat a couple of weeks back by Swansea, but every side has one of them a season at some point. Apart from that, on the road this season, away from home against smaller sides, we've been really, really impressive.
Yeah, this Liverpool side doesn't seem to have the flaws of even recent Jurgen Klopp sides in these types of fixtures. Yesterday, people were telling me, "Oh, Southampton had a game there at the weekend." And I don't think this Liverpool side sees it that way anymore. Don't get me wrong; we're saying this. We had Swansea the other week and lost bottom of the league. But I would say that is now sort of an anomaly. There we go. Rather than just like the normal course of things, Liverpool have got almost like a ruggedness and a confidence at 1-0, at 2-0. I mean, don't get me wrong, the second goal helped because there was a header where Carrillo got. Carrius made a couple of decent saves. But there's almost like, I think, that a newfound confidence in Liverpool to see games out in not, you know, they always say 2-0 is not a safe lead. It sort of is, but, you know, it's there's a game even under Jurgen Klopp where, under Koeman,
The 3-2, yeah.
Yeah, the 3-2. And that was almost commonplace for this Liverpool side. We've seen it.
Well, we played better in the first half in that 3-2 than we did in this 2-0.
Absolutely. And I wonder whether there's been a little bit of give and take. So I don't think we're quite as fluid as we were in certain times under Jurgen Klopp. I harp on shows regularly about a period of time where we played Watford at home, who came and they were seventh place in the league. Leicester came. And there was another fixture.
Hull.
Yeah, Hull. And we were demolishing sides. And, you know, attacking-wise, we were brilliant. But then you'd get a side, you'd come and try and have a go at you. And Liverpool could crumble. We've even seen it at the King Power with Leicester this year, where if it's not for a Simon Mignolet pen, that Liverpool could have thrown away what looked an unassailable lead. I don't really sit there watching Liverpool anymore feeling that way. And at 2-0 yesterday, when you referenced that 3-2 game, I thought, nah, not a chance, not with this side.
Yeah, and I think after the game really sort of pleases you just to see how we kind of came out that little spell where we thought maybe Southampton might nick something out of it. And, you know, I think it's always been talked about, Liverpool are very good at sort of gifting goals and, you know, teams never really have to earn their goal. And I think we kind of want to see players like our goalkeeper giving, sort of bailing out other players in little instances. So I think that Robertson example in the first half, where Karius makes a really, really good save. And it's just great to see that there's that solidity now and we can sort of rely on certain individuals to bail each other out, you know, sort of like De Gea does at Man United.
I want to talk about the goalkeeper. I think this is his first, go to you first, Neil, on this. I think this is his first proper, he can mark a clean sheet in his diary and feel like he was integral to it. I think it's a big deal, that performance yesterday. I hope it is, but I think it is as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Fouad's right in terms of Liverpool made mistakes in that first half. Both fullbacks were caught too narrow, getting caught under the ball and exposed back post. And how many times have we seen that at Liverpool? You know, decent start, good position, and a simple header or a cross, and it cost them. And both times, Karius, you know, Not spectacular, just correct and doing things right and not being, you know, not making an error, not being beaten where you look at it and think that, how's that gone in, or, you know, could he have done a bit more? I liked his part in the first goal where he's distributing it quickly and he's throwing it out to Oxlade-Chamberlain. It shows that he's got his head clearer than it certainly has looked in previous games. It's got to help. It's got to help that if he's a bit more confident of his position, because I personally think it was overplayed last season that he was picked as number one by Klopp. I'm not convinced he would have been, but for the broken hand, I think he would have given them both the pre-season to show and it would have been up to performances. But when he came in, he made them errors, Bournemouth especially, West Ham, I actually thought West Ham was a worse or a poorer error than Bournemouth, because it was so odd. Bournemouth, anyone can make a handling error, but West Ham was odd. And then he's had to come in this season for the odd game. I don't think that's ideal, where you're thinking, you're almost hoping to have shots to try and make things happen with. I think now he just looks like he's just part of the team now. He's just part of the furniture, and he's just going to hopefully continue giving good performances. I still think he's got boxes to tick, but I hope he plays against Porto on Wednesday, because I don't see any benefit in continually moving these goalkeepers around. I think we've already seen what it's done to Mignolet. We saw at the West Brom game what it's done to him. So I would keep him out of the firing line now.
I agree with that, by the way. I think you've just got to play Karius all the way through now, if this is your decision. I would say actually this is the first time I've actually had positive thoughts around the goalkeeper. I think not that long ago, I was maybe saying he was the worst signing the club's ever made, because I couldn't find a single positive. I hadn't seen him save a shot, and that it was almost that basic that I felt there's literally nothing I like about this goalkeeper. I'd almost include the Tottenham game as well. I know he doesn't cover himself particularly in glory for Wanyama's goal, but he does get some distance on it. I think 99 out of 100 times he gets away with that a lot of the times. But no, I felt yesterday he's starting to enable, I think him and Trent as well, to be fair, were starting to enable a number of swift counter-attacking moves by just having the brains to release the ball quickly. And there was times in the game where I noticed he'd thrown it and it was intercepted by Southampton. And I thought, well, actually, he's the firepower we've got, you're going to have to take them risks. And I don't think Mignolet was. He was almost too safe, where with Karius, You know, he was releasing it to Trent. Trent was finding Salah in well more space than he should have been in. But Klopp, it was interesting. Klopp had sort of picked up on it, that he was enabling this quick counter attack. And I wonder whether this is one of goalkeepers obviously now bought more from just goalkeeping. You see the likes of Edison at City, that they're being bought for enabling quick attacks, quick thinking. Don't let the other side reset. And for the first time, I would say yesterday, we've seen the real benefits of Karius doing that.
I totally agree. I thought he was really good yesterday. And the point's been made there. You know, sometimes you just need your goalkeeper in big moments in football matches to kind of pull you up the shit a little bit. And he does that on a couple of occasions. I think he takes the confidence he's gained from the Spurs match into that game as well. Because I think, Paul, you referenced the kind of semi-mistake, I suppose, for the Wanyama goal. But around that goal, I thought he was excellent in that Spurs game. He makes some really crucial saves. You know, the Son one, where he's kind of through one-on-one, where he knows he's going to get clattered, but he's off his line really quick. He does that again yesterday when that ball gets floated over by Hoyt, and I think Hulberg has the shot, but he's on him in an instant. And I just think when you compare the two goalkeepers, and you can have a conversation around, you know, who's the better keeper, etc. But in terms of who suits this Liverpool team, who suits a Jurgen Klopp football team, then for me there's absolutely no doubt that Karius is that man in terms of Mignolet, in terms of being over Mignolet. I think if you were to ask me right now, would I still want to look at a goalkeeper in the summer? Absolutely yes. I think it's something that right here, right now, we still have to be looking to do in terms of business. But I enjoyed his performance yesterday, and I think in terms of Mignolet, I'd stopped enjoying watching him in goal for Liverpool. You know, over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, I think there's just been too many times where he's let us down. And listen, there's been some really kind of decent performances from him as well. So I don't want to sound too unfair, but the sample size
is so much greater, isn't it? So you know what there's been that many instances where Mignolet's let you down.
Exactly, Paul. And Mignolet's not going to get any better, and I think... No. He knows his time's up now, and Neil's point before about the West Brom game is absolutely right. There's now no benefit to playing him again for me. You've got to give Karius a run. You've got to do him a service now by saying, right, the rest of the season is yours. I think there's real kind of makings of a good understanding with his kind of two centre-halves as well, although they changed that for yesterday's game. But you kind of sense that Van Dijk coming into the side helps that as well. And I actually thought in the Spurs match, him, Lovren and Karius were all communicating and looking much more of a unit. And as I say, yesterday, he doesn't have anything to do in the second half, but all the things he does in the first half point to the fact that he now deserves a run in this football team, and I hope he gets it.
There was the club released a video last week of him. It was at home with Loris Karius thing. I just had a baby, so I was scouring YouTube and whatnot for anything football related to keep me sane. And so I watched this clip on the club website, and what surprised me about him, he's so articulate, and he was talking about how determined he was to make this work, and you know, the sort of mental battles he'd been through and whatnot. But I was really impressed by his manner and how he came across, and how much he believes in himself. So there was a period where I was thinking, you're just another run in the mill keeper, but I think he's very aware that he's a very able goalkeeper, and that things haven't gone so well for him, but his mindset very much seemed that he was determined to make things right, and I was pleased to hear it.
Yeah, and I think going along with that interview, I watched it as well, and the thing that really I really enjoyed yesterday was seeing the control in which he played. You know, I've never played as a goalkeeper, but you can kind of see psychologically is probably the most demanding position on the pitch, and you know, having the ability to, for instance, the save he made, I think it was the header, Ward-Prowse, and he was about to come out and punch the ball, and he just stepped back just before he came out, and I think he just played with a level head, and I'm not sure if I'm sure that's his personality and the type of guy he is, but I think Van Dijk, as you mentioned before, I think he's going to bring that sort of calm and just level headedness to the whole unit defensively.
I think you've got to remember as well, he's not a superstar Liverpool have signed. He's signed for the same price as Ragnar Klavan, virtually, you know, and he's come in. So he's obviously not the complete goalkeeper. He's not, you know, an established German international even. He's played for Mainz in Germany. So to expect him to be perfect was probably, was definitely unreasonable. I think what you've seen is the inconsistency that means that he played for Mainz, that means that he cost £4.5 million. that means that Liverpool were able to get him as well. At that time, it wasn't going to one of the big boys. So I think it was always going to take a little bit of time for him. I agree with Paul in terms of I didn't see a lot of positivity in his first season at all. I thought even, you know, I think he came with a reputation as being really good with his feet, and I didn't see that one bit. He looks...
Kicked it out for a corner from a goal kick.
Yeah, well,
takes some doing. Try and do it.
That'll go down as one of his greatest ever achievements in his career, whatever he goes on to do at Liverpool. But I think for a £4 million goalkeeper, he was a bit of a punt, in my opinion. And I think the signs at the moment that he might just be a Liverpool player for the future. I agree, though, with Ian, that I think it's priority number one for me in the summer is Liverpool signing a goalkeeper.
Is there something in, you've all sort of discussed the mindset to some degree, is there something in the idea that he gets to feel fully involved in the game, Ian? You know, and we're discussing the quick throwouts and all that sort of stuff, that what he wants to be is he actually wants to be the 11th man on the pitch. And so this is, you know, when you're talking about the psychological angle, that if anything almost first half, and you said before, it's almost like you're willing shots, if anything first half, he's almost busy enough to feel as though he is, right, I'm part of this here today. Yeah, I mean, he's not too busy, but he's busy enough, he's doing some good stuff and all of that. Do you think that's part of this? And then you know, balling the ball out quickly, and that keeps you switched on, that keeps you aware, rather than being the lads who's just there for when he gets called into action.
I think that definitely plays a part. I think, you know, Paul touched on it before, in terms of what you expect from a modern goalkeeper, the game's moved on hugely. You know, we've seen the success that obviously Edison's brought to the Man City team, and I think you're right, and you know, it's been mentioned that around that first goal where he's got that instinctive, his first thought is, right, what am I doing with the ball now, let's release it now. But that won't always go right. Sometimes Paul mentioned, you take a gamble, you take a risk, it could get cut out, and then the Liverpool team sort of spring on them and try and win it back. But I think he is involved, and he feels like he is the start of the attack in many instances, because, you know, that transition period where we want to go from back to front very quickly, and he's very much part of that in terms of getting that ball out nice and quick, whether it be with his hands or with his feet. And I also think the fact that the manager's come out and now said, you are my number one. Now, from a player point of view, from an individual point of view, that must give you confidence. You must think, right, I've got an opportunity to make this my kind of claim for the first team kind of spot. And who knows what will happen in the summer, but he's almost got nothing to lose for me now. He's just got these kind of run of games, whether it be Champions League or League, where he can just go out and we can see what he's about. And as I say, there's real kind of green shoots of recovery in that performance yesterday, and I am looking forward to watching him play again for us, hopefully on Wednesday night.
There is a small benefit, well, there is a massive benefit actually, that I feel he's getting, which no one's really talking about, is he's the Liverpool goalkeeper who's got Virgil van Dijk in front of him now for a prolonged period. So I would almost say he's under the least pressure of any Liverpool goalkeeper in a while. I thought yesterday van Dijk has got, for the first time, looked like the leader in the defence, where I was almost surprised that there was parts of it in the Everton game where I thought, oh yeah, you can see the leader in him. And then almost that he was just biding his time before he spoke up as a Liverpool player. But yesterday, there was the first real sign I thought, oh wow, this defence has got a leader. Someone who was... I noticed there was a point where van Dijk was 5 yards ahead of the rest of the back four, and all of a sudden they pushed out to him, and you could see who was orchestrating things for the first time. And I think Karius, he's not fortunate, and I'm not taking anything away from him, but there is a slight benefit here for him, the fact that Liverpool have now got someone who's stopping the chaos in front of them at the Raspin.
And I think with that, I think it's also been benefiting the lads in front of him. So the midfield three, I think, really benefited from having... I don't think Chan has really had a centre half behind him who's been pulling him around, telling him to fill in here, telling him to fill in there. I mean, I noticed one point where Van Dijk was literally screaming at him just to come back into the little gap from a throw-in. And, you know, Chan, as soon as he saw, he noticed, he filled in. And that's the sort of thing that you want your centre halves to be doing. And you know, we've had Lovren sort of, when he came in, he was thought to be the one that would provide that leadership, and you know, he struggled to do that, and you know, Van Dijk's come in and pretty much instantly earned the respect to do that within the scene.
There was things, just little things I was picking up on there, like so Van Dijk would shield an oncoming striker, and it was almost very last ditch with the goalkeeper to come and collect the ball that he'd stepped in front of, and you could almost see Van Dijk's bemusement about what was actually going on, because you do this in Sunday League, you know, someone that step across the centre half and the goalkeeper comes and sweeps it up, that's commonplace, but it's almost like he's reminding them how to defend and how the goalkeeper's meant to do these very basic things. Once again, it's brilliant. I could talk about Van Dijk's performance yesterday all day. I really, really enjoyed his second half performance. I know we weren't under any form of pressure whatsoever, really, but there was just a silkiness about him for a centre half, a reassurance in his own ability that ball, I'll have that. You know, oh, that's coming across. I'm going to step out, and then I'm going to go past you, and I'm going to make a perfect pass. You saw every single bit of a £75 million centre half playing for Liverpool yesterday.
Yeah, I love the step over as well when he got to the edge of the box.
Absolutely brilliant.
I'm going to put this on my right foot. And I'm going to bend it in the far corner from 25 yards. But he looked like he was enjoying it as well. I know my colleague James Pearce spoke to him after the Tottenham game and gave him some quite explosive stuff about Harry Kane, obviously. And that was his first meeting with Van Dijk, so it was like, what was he like? And I sort of said to him, big fella. He was like, oh yeah, big fella. He said, he didn't come across as I've thought he was going to be, like a real aura about him. He said he was just quite a laid back guy. You know, he wasn't sort of like this dominant figure that you'd associated with some of the Van Dijk stuff we've almost pictured him
as a god, because yeah, like
Ron Yates sort of character, yeah. Who's going to walk in and, you know, have a walk around him and that. But he said he was just quite laid back and quite you know, seemed quite happy, which is not a bad thing, is it, when you think of some of the stuff Dejan Lovren and Joel Matip. I thought, on the contrast to Van Dijk, I thought Matip was awful yesterday. Personally, I thought he was absolutely dreadful. He managed to play one out, I think, behind him. What are you doing? Did the same at Huddersfield. But then again, he steps into midfield a bit more confident and sets up a chance, albeit, you know, it wasn't exactly put on a plate for Salah and Firmino. But I still think there's a slot up for grabs as Virgil's partner, personally, and I wouldn't say either of them have put the names forward yet.
I kind of agree with that. I think in terms of Van Dijk, he does lose class, and it's a joy to kind of watch him play. And Neil, your point there, nothing seems to faze him. He just doesn't seem bothered. I mean, you see other players return to former clubs, and I don't think Southampton were the most vociferous I've ever seen him yesterday, but you can see how it gets in players' minds sometimes. And
he got pushed over, didn't he, in the second half towards like the left back, and he just sort of bounced up as if like,
He just looked like he was going through the game, chuckling and laughing to himself, saying, yeah, I'm not on the arse about
he
this
was.
At all. You know, exactly, you know, this doesn't bother me at all. If you think this faces me, you've got another thing coming.
But he's the winner. And the thing is, Southampton can scream and shout at him all they like. I said about Javier Mascherano on a show the other week. I was so upset when Mascherano left, but when he leaves Barcelona, they're showing you his three European Cups, his eight leagues, and yeah. Liverpool have won a Carling Cup or something since he's gone, and you go,
you can't,
yeah, who's the winner here? Yeah. And
he stopped booing him by the end as well, didn't he? He didn't even bother.
He was bored of it, and I think Fred's point before was right about, he's not just controlling the back four, he's shouting at his midfield as well. It's that old Patrick Vieira thing. No matter how good you are as a midfield player, sometimes you've got no idea what's going on behind you. And he'd regularly say to a centre-half, listen, don't worry about it. If I'm out of position, you tell me. You tell me where to go, you tell me where to move. I can see everything in front of me, but I can't see what's going on behind me. And Van Dijk does that, and he kind of transmits through the team. So, massively impressed with him again. I felt he's starting to really put a marker down. I agree with the point about the centre-halves. I think if I was looking towards Wednesday's game, and I know we'll come on to it in a bit, for me, I'd go with Lovren. I'm not similar to Paul. I'm not Matip's biggest fan. I'm not Lovren's biggest fan of him, if I'm being totally honest. I think there's absolutely room for an upgrade on both centre-halves. But there was the makings of a decent partnership, I thought, with Lovren and Van Dijk, and I'd like to see him explore that a bit more.
Yeah, I think with Lovren, it brings a bit more balance in the partnership. I've seen it kind of widely said that the Van Dijk kind of signing feels more like a Matip upgrade than anything else. And I think Lovren did, you know, he has been kind of had a lot of stick for the Spurs game where he, I think he deflected off him for the goal or the penalty. And he, other than that, he was very dominant. I mean, in the air, he won everything. The fact that Harry Kane was as quiet as he's ever been, I think, just goes to show.
Especially on the back of what in the reverse fixture, I thought Lovren coped with it really well, and I was almost upset about him slicing through that ball for him on a personal level, because I thought mentally he battled and won. You know, against Harry Kane, there was bits in the air where he wasn't getting anywhere near it at Wembley, but at Anfield, he was on top. He was letting them run into channels and sort of seeing them off. And I thought, yeah, looks good that. I think, and I thought, oh, Klopp will settle with that, and he didn't play him in this game, much to me.
Do you think he was left out for Porto, though?
Quite possibly. I mean, Klopp was saying in his press conference that, yeah, well, there could be all of that, but Klopp was saying in his press conference, you know, I'm taking one game at a time, but obviously the Jordan Henderson thing is obviously because Emre Can's banned, doesn't even make the squad, he didn't want any need to use him whatsoever. So maybe, but then again, I don't want a situation which we've had with the goalkeepers where no one knows if he starts. I want to see a settle back four.
There is, though, on Lovren, come to you, Neil, on this, there is a thing around both Lovren and Matip to lay it out there where they are pro to picking up odd little injuries here and there.
Absolutely.
And it may well be that, you know, at times I've looked at it and thought, Dejan Lovren, 3 games in a week, I'm not sure. Yeah. And it may well be that he's looked at that and he's thought, you know what, I'm going to protect this lad here. That could be in his thought process.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with Van Dijk not necessarily being straight at match fitness and able to go there. But I would probably go with Lovren as well on Wednesday night. I think he's so weird, isn't he, Lovren, like, in terms of, not in a personality sense, in a sense that he's had a good season with the lowest of the lows in the middle of it as well. Like, you know, it's just as bad, is so bad, but his general play is good. You know, he's generally a decent defender.
I think he's excellent, Neil, until he's not. Do you know
that's
that is Dejan Lovren for me, and you see that a lot with goalkeepers and whatnot. You go, oh, he's brilliant, and then he makes a clanger. So
one brings two.
Yeah, that's my thing. I don't ever think Dejan Lovren's terrible in general play until he's made a personal error.
But the same with Matip, I don't see Matip as being so much more reliable than him. I think he looks quite good when he's playing well. And at Huddersfield, I think he had the record number of passes in the game because Huddersfield went home, I think, after 15 minutes and didn't even try and press Liverpool, so he just had the ball. But I don't see him doing things as a defender where you go, wow, that was probably, you know, he was there, the ball came in and he went and won it because you could see him. I think you see Lovren do that more than he does. You see Van Dijk do it, he's like a magnet when a ball comes in off a set piece.
I mean, you'd say that Van Dijk and Lovren are much more aggressive than say Matip. Yeah. What I would say about Matip, that I do think maybe it's kind of overlooked a little bit. I think he does like to fizz balls into the midfield and the forwards. Definitely, which kind of breaks lines a little bit. Lovren doesn't really do an awful lot of that for me, and I think if there's games where you kind of want your centre-half to be kind of more involved and coming out and bringing a ball and pinging balls in through those gaps in midfield, then Matip's more about doing that. Paul's point there, interesting about Lovren, because I think he's so capable of having 9 out of 10s, but then he's capable of having that 3. And I used to think that about Saka as well. When Saka was here, he could be a 9 in any one given game. And next minute, he delivers a 3, and you're thinking, what's going on there? So there's that inconsistency thing that I think hangs over the pair of them, which is why, you know, there's a question for the manager to see whether he maybe looks at Gomez next season, or does he actually go out and bring another one to the football club. It'd be interesting.
I think as well, it's almost the manager, he's hanging himself a little bit of love. If he picks Lovren and Lovren has another Lovren, it's like well, you've had so many warnings and then it looks worse and worse. I think the same with Mignolet. It was you know, how many chances do you give? But he might not. You know, he might just be fine alongside Van Dijk. That might be the making of him as a defender. It's a risk and reward thing. I still think there'll be lots of chopping and changing between those two in the next 12 games or so, but I'd like to see Lovren given his chance on Wednesday night at least.
I wonder if there might be one or two home games towards the end of the season where you maybe see Gomez if Klein's back. It might be that's where you might just
almost like it was at the year where Carragher went centre half for the
last four or five games.
Yeah, it was the defence. I don't know whether we just played too many games now, but when I was growing up and whatnot, it's the back five and then what's in front of them, and I don't see this really at many clubs now, but the one thing I will say is the clubs that seem to be successful are the ones that seem to have a settled back five. So you look at Tottenham in recent years, you could go, well, yeah, it's Lloris in goal, it was Kyle Walker, Danny Rose, Vertonghen and Alderweireld, and then it's felt a bit for Tottenham. Why? Oh yeah, Vertonghen's out again. There was this, they're playing Kevin Vimmer there, who's not quite at the same level. So I think if we were talking about the importance of the business in the summer being attaining the goalkeeper, but I also think either we settle on the centre half between now and the end of the season. I don't think it's going to be Joe Gomez. I've just got this feeling where he might have been put to right back now for maybe even the rest of his career under Jurgen Klopp. Anyway, I can see a centre half again being one of the main targets for the summer.
Yeah, and I think I think definitely there's room for a starting centre half alongside Van Dijk, and I don't think you're doing too bad if you're having Lovren as your sort of third centre half coming in rotation or whatever. But I think the pre-season will be massive in terms of finding that partner for Van Dijk if we're sticking with Lovren and Matip. And with Joe Gomez, you kind of see the makings of a real quality centre half. I don't think there's too much to say about his defensive side. He has been suspect a couple of times with a few balls coming across and that. But he does seem like he could be a real good fit alongside Van Dijk. But then again, I think when Klein comes back, probably still see the rotation between them two.
And by the way, listening to you talk through all of this, if I'm Ranieri Clive and I'm desperate to play right side at centre half and trade in matches,
yeah,
and yeah. Say I can do this side as well if you want, Gaffer. I'll do you little bits and pieces here. Thought Oxlade-Chamberlain, Neil, was. I feel a bit sorry for him at the minute in that he has the great performance against City, but to me he seems like the biggest victim of the Coutinho situation. Since then he's only been used mostly off the bench to come in and play in the front three and not in midfield. He got his opportunity back in midfield there against Southampton, and he wasn't quite as the level he had been. He looked like a lad who hasn't had enough football. When the manager talks about things like not in rhythm, that was what I was seeing.
I don't know about Oxlade-Chamberlain, mate. It's one of them. He's just an inconsistent player, isn't he? He always has been, really. He's not someone who you'd go has particularly great runs of form. He just sort of has great games and moments and efforts in games. And I'm still not convinced about him as a midfielder. He was brilliant against City, really was, and you can't argue with that. And you know, I have a couple of mates who are big fans of him, and every time he does anything in a game, I get a text that just an ox, you know, an emoji of an ox. But that's still all he does for me. I don't think he's particularly good in tight areas. I don't think he's pretty good in 1-2s or that kind of situation. He needs space to run into. He needs, you know, the game to be set for him. I don't yet see him as a starting midfielder week in, week out. I see him as a very good squad player to come on in games or to play in a rotation for one of the wide players, possibly for Mane in some games to come. But still, yeah, I thought he looked a bit Oxlade-Chamberlain yesterday. That to me, you know, from the height to the sort of the net.
I thought one of the things as well in it, and I thought Milner impressed when he came on. I thought he was, you felt Milner was very, very involved. You thought Lallana looked lively when he came on. It seems to me it's a bit of a, in the context of sort of seeing everyone against those opponents. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to see Oxlade-Chamberlain get chances between now and the end of the season, but it is. He's going to have to grab them. He's got 11 more games that he can pop. Well, Champions League aside, he's got 11 more games he can play in for Liverpool this season. He is going to get those opportunities, but I'd like to see him run with it a bit more.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think in terms of the inconsistent point about him, I don't think it helps when he's coming in and out of the team. He strikes me as a player who needs the belief of the manager. He needs to be playing regular football to almost find his rhythm. And he is coming in and out of the team a little bit. And there will be a time for him to adjust to playing under this manager as well. I think we all kind of thought after the City game, right, he's kind of found this manager and he's just going to go on this massive, brilliant run now. But he comes out the team, which I don't think helps. But he's been under Wenger for a long, long time. And I think under that manager, he was with a manager who didn't really trust him, didn't really believe in him, always took him out in the big moments. We'll play him in some games, take him out the team. So I think a longer run benefits him. But it's difficult because I think, we speak about Milner there, I think there's certain games that suit certain footballers. Milner comes on yesterday, I think it suited him absolutely perfectly. When he played against Spurs, that felt to me like a game that wouldn't suit him. To be fair, he proved me wrong for the first hour. He goes, that's a good game. So I think the manager will just look at it game by game and think, right, there's games that will suit certain footballers. I think ideally we're still missing someone in that kind of midfield three, maybe who's a bit more creative than what we've currently got. It all feels a little bit horses for courses at times, and a lot of the lads are facilitators, they're doing the same things, but they're not actually kind of doing anything a little bit special, a little bit kind of off the cuff. And I think that's something that hopefully doesn't kind of cause us too much of an issue. But I think in certain games, you mentioned, Neil, in your agenda, a lot of games that we've got coming up at home and against sides who, you know, they're in the bottom kind of half of the league, they could come in, they could be passive, they could sit in, not offer much. You're looking at your midfield three there and thinking, right, who's going to be the guy who can kind of take hold of this game and feed those front three players? So, interesting.
Yeah, and with that, I mean, we talked about Ox coming in front three as well, but you just don't feel he has that same sort of quality or the ability to kind of link up with the other two. Because, I mean, we look at the way Salah and Firmino kind of link up the both goals. You just feel Ox isn't quite at that level in terms of his attacking play. And in the midfield, he has the ability to drive and the passing ability in terms of feeding in these front three players is definitely there. One thing I would say is it felt like a game where Danny Ings would have been a really, really good substitution, especially, I think, towards the end, where I think he took off Salah and brought Lovren on. I think maybe that was to...
It's just on the wind. Yeah.
It might have been a game really to bring him on because it really wasn't anything going to happen in terms of...
A chance just to give him a run.
And yeah, if he's going to get some more minutes in the next few games, then would have been a real good opportunity to get some under his belt.
Well, there's just on that though, when we're talking about that, and it's come to me whilst we're talking, it's not written down anywhere, Paul. We talk about this front three, and at the minute, one of the conversations we're having is Sadio Mane's form's not quite where we want it to be, although I thought he was doing some things I liked against Southampton. But this is a really hard front three to come in and play with. You know, the level that you've got to be at, and that all season when we've been watching Solanke, and maybe you'd be, in hindsight, maybe our criticism of him's almost a bit harsh because these lads, that front three, they're absolutely mustard. They are absolutely brilliant. The idea you can just slot into that level of understanding, into those blind passes, those passes around the corner, knowing someone's going to be there. That is not an easy front three to come in and just be part of overnight.
No, being at that level at any football club is a difficult task, and then coming in when you're replacing one of that three in that system where there's almost a sort of telepathy between them is nearly the impossible job, especially if you're a young 20-year-old centre forward who's not got much Premier League experience. So sympathising with players like Solanke and Danny Ings, who's, you know, returning from long term injury, not really had a run at this club at all, despite the fact he's been here for so long. It's a very difficult job. I was watching the Manchester City Leicester game on Saturday night, and I've had this feeling for a while, but I honestly think Vardy would be one of the players who could come into the side and sort of make a difference in terms of the way we play. You know, he's one of them fellas who only needs one chance, and you see Leicester basically get the one chance the other day, and Vardy slots. There's not many footballers in Europe, I don't think, who could improve that front three, but I think as another option, someone who it doesn't take three or four goes, who can run the line on his own almost. You know, if it's not working for Mane, as we've seen in previous games, or, you know, Salah's not having one of these days, he quite frequently has. I think Vardy could be almost like a great foil. Almost, you could almost drop Firmino into a number 10, go 4-2-3-1, and then let Vardy operate almost in his own. I'm sure there's much nicer humans across world football that you could almost find an equivalent to.
You're discussing the characteristics. That's the characteristics.
Yeah,
that we should be
looking but what I'm saying is, I think someone who can do that job, where he can almost act as an independent amongst that three, if it's not working, is the only cure if it's not working on that day.
The easier way to do that. One of the things that was striking me when I was watching it, Neil, is where do you defend against them? Where do you put your line? Because if you sit.
Yeah.
They can all score from 20 yards. They can also, they're more than capable of running past you in tight spaces. I mean, they don't always do it. We saw it against Swansea. Some days they won't play well. Yeah. Some days it won't quite come together. But you push up and they're going to kill you. I was just watching it go, and I've got no idea really now if they're going to all have 8 out of 10 games, or two of them have an 8 out of 10 game. What do you do if you're trying to defend it?
Yeah, you have to have a lot of luck. I think that the accepted way is to go deep. I think that's the best way, because I still think the less likely to score from outside the box this team, especially the Liverpool midfield. I don't see anyone. Chan's shown a couple of times that he can do it, but I don't see. I'd rather them shooting from there than Salah with space to run into behind. But Salah's he's so good. I say that as a massive fan of Firmino. Salah's just a game changer for Liverpool, because it doesn't bother him. Nothing ever bothers him. You know, you see strikers, and Michael Owen used to have it where if Michael Owen was on a bad run, you knew Michael Owen was on a bad run. You could see every time he went through, you'd think, nah, not scoring, get a penalty, put it down, he's not scoring this one because his head's gone. Salah, he can miss 10 chances in a row, and you know he'll score the 11th because he'll just do exactly what he would have done the first time. You know, he doesn't seem to have any sort of mental block at the moment. He's just playing with that freedom that can only come with knowing that you're in great form. And when you've got Firmino there, I mean, Firmino, you talk about the... I swear it was, I mean, so he's an echo columnist, so I shouldn't really be...
Nah,
but John Aldridge told him you need a 30-goal-a-season striker when Salah's on 29 now and Firmino's on 20. John, you're 6 months late, mate. You know, you need to have a look. But you think he's doing that and everything else, and those sneaky blindside presses that he does where he lets the midfielder engage the player, and then he like creeps up behind him and nicks his wallet off the other side of his pocket. You know, it's so important, and it allows Liverpool and Salah and people like that to just go and just know that it's going to be all right. The ball will get there. If it doesn't get there this time, it'll get there next time. And those two are just absolute dynamite. And we're talking about Mane being off form. He's still got 9 goals this season. He's still, you know, some memorable moments from the season. He'll still come good again. He looks like he looks to me like he's I wish I was playing as well as those two. Like, I'll try and do this. And
because he was the catalyst, wasn't he? He was the one that everyone looked at. I almost feel like he's had to become like the small fish, and it's not suited him a little bit. Where I think the ego thing almost helped.
The decoy, almost.
But there was a period, you know, in January, you're talking, oh, Liverpool haven't got Mane, and I think Mane was sitting there buzzing off that. Where this year, you know, the wealth's been spread so much that it might have even affected his confidence.
I think as well, in terms of Salah and Firmino, their kind of reputation goes before them now as well, because you can see it in players' heads before they've even started the game. I mean, Wesley Hoy goes into that game and has the worst 5 minutes of his life. You know, his head just goes in the first, he doesn't know what's going on. He's just panicking, and every single time the ball goes anywhere near the box and he's all over the show, he gets away with one when he kind of puts his hand on Firmino's shoulder. He kind of goes down a little bit too easy. But even then, I'm thinking, they're all over the show here. And then obviously the goal comes from, you know, Ox's ball. And again, he's just panicked. He doesn't know where Salah is. Before he knows anything, the ball's in the back of the net. And that first goal, I mean, the kind of telepathic understanding, Salah doesn't even really look to see where Firmino. He just knows that, you know, good players know where good players are going to be. And he just kind of plays that ball almost blindside. And the finish, it's underrated, because you're thinking about the second goal and all that kind of surrounds that, in terms of that brilliant understanding between two players at the absolute top of the game. But that first finish from Firmino, it's just so nonchalant. We're taking it with his left foot. I mean, McCarthy in goal doesn't even get a sniff of it before he's even thought about diving. It's in the back of the net.
I was screaming for him to leave it to Mane, because I thought Mane was coming onto it on his right foot, and I thought, oh, you don't... That's Firmino's... It's awkward on his lefty. That's just the confidence for you. If you believe in yourself, you'll take that first time and it'll go in the bottom corner every time.
I think the point before about how to set up against him, I feel like it's, you know, the manager's almost like, do you know when you play chess and your mate says, oh, it's checkmate, then you go, no, he's got me there. I think these managers must be looking at that going, what do? I play a lopsided defence with a sweeper, you know, to cover every eventuality? Oh, and then I've got to think about us actually being in the game somewhat. So I've dealt with their attack, but actually I've got 7 lads there playing in a wavy line.
We're 18th, we need to win, we're at home.
Yeah, exactly. And it's almost impossible. The thing with Salah is I just don't know how anyone plays him, because there's lads talk about Vardy before, you know, don't give Vardy space in behind, okay, put 4 lads behind him. Yeah, you might have counteracted them there. Salah, you see him, the goal he scores at Tottenham, I'll just dance around you. You know, the first half, Trent's putting them balls down the side. What do you do? How do you stop it?
There's no space in behind for that second goal yesterday, really, is there? That's a 5-yard start, and he's got in a clean through on goal with a 1-2 around someone.
You've almost got to abandon worrying about offside and stuff like that. The headaches Liverpool must be causing are incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the way he kind of manipulates the ball, he's sort of now getting that treatment you kind of see Messi and Ronaldo and these sort of players get in Europe, where the way the kind of defenders literally stand off. And I saw it a couple of times yesterday where, I mean, he was dribbling and There were two defenders around him, and they both literally just completely step back, and they're just sort of waiting for him to either take a poor touch. There's no real kind of proactive defending in terms of trying to go in for the tackles, because you just push it around you.
There was a real ballsy move yesterday from Klopp as well, which I think if you're ever going to look back on a Jurgen Klopp era, these are the little decisions I think he makes where you can go, oh, I really enjoyed him. You're playing against Ryan Bertrand on this side there. Yes, he's a tremendous attacking threat. And within about 5 minutes, you realise that Salah's been told, don't worry about tracking him. Mm. And you've got Trent Alexander-Arnold there, who's a kid, he probably isn't a right back, not the most perfect defensive fullback in the world. And he's gone, yeah, do you know what? They'll worry more about you than we will about them. And that's an attitude thing, yeah. which is an elite club attitude thing. So Cristiano Ronaldo, don't you worry about Jordi Alba or whatever, you know. Well, exactly, let him worry about you.
That was, I mean, if you see the Wayne Rooney interview when he talks to Carragher, and Wayne Rooney, obviously, you know, he was an elite footballer, but he was being asked to do other things almost to cover Ronaldo's work rate. Mm. But he didn't mind because he was that good. Well, we want him fresh in the final third every single time we've got the ball. And you can see there's a little bit of that about Mohamed Salah now, where other players are willing to do the extra yard because you want him absolutely in the zone when we've got the ball in the final third.
He's the key to their success, almost.
We want to win the game, we'll have the largest cause of goals.
I want to go to Liverpool and win trophies, but do you know what? I'll sacrifice my own ego a little bit because he is really the key to it.
I sort of remember an interview with Rob Lee, who used to play for Newcastle, and he was talking about Ginola, and he said he signed Ginola and he said a couple of training games. He said he wasn't the right back. They were overloading on Newcastle's left back. So the reserves, I think it was. He said a couple of the players went to Keegan and said, look, he's not tracking, you know, but John Beresford here has got two to deal with. And he said, so? He said, we'll do a bit more then. He said, he'll win us the league if you get the ball to him enough. And that's, you know, it doesn't sound nice if you're one of the players who isn't the player who's going to win you the league, but it's the truth, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter if James Milner has to shuttle across a bit more, or Emre Can's, you know, can't get his boots off his feet at the end of the game, because chances are Mo Salah and Roberto Firmino have done the business and they've won.
And I think it kind of goes back to the whole Mane thing, because there were times where it was a bit of a 4-4-2 and you could just see him doing most of the grafting and having to tuck in, and Salah and Firmino kind of left to scurry around and try and nick the ball off players, and then that quick ball down from Trent or even Oxlade-Chamberlain for the first goal. It was just to unlock them, and I think when you have a player in that sort of form, you have to try and do as much as you can to get him in those sort of positions.
I'm not really a big stats sort of guy, but I quite like them maps where it shows you at the end of the game where everyone's position was throughout the game. I don't know what the technical term for them is.
Heat map.
Average position. Average,
yeah, that one, yeah. And you can just see Salah, it's almost like right-sided, but almost 5, 7, 8 yards further on than anyone else. You know, his role, and we sort of see this, Neil, and doing the Roto League stuff and his contributions, his role is now simply put the ball in the back of the net, take on defenders, enable the other two lads that you're playing up front with, and don't worry about anything else behind you.
He's a striker who plays from the right, and it's a flip version of Henry.
Yeah, I was going to say, Henry's the only sort of... Well, he's the obvious example of someone who pulls from one side and just is absolutely devastating. I don't actually think yesterday was Salah's greatest game. I think he was afforded opportunity to have a greatest game. But this is it, as you say about Michael Owen. The flip side of Michael Owen is Michael Owen could have just had games like that where there wasn't much on for him, but he was just so much better than everyone else on the pitch that he gets his goal, he gets an assist, and you come off going, I thought, you know, Owen contributed, but he wasn't great. That's the level he's at.
And this is one of the reasons why I actually think, for instance, he might well outscore Suarez 13-14 this season. But they're not. That drill's got very, very loud. They're very industrial today.
There is
something though where there's not a showiness about it. The Spurs goal aside, it's not like loads of this stuff is, he was unreal today. He's did this. Did you remember when he did that? Oh my God. There's not really a ton of that. But I mean this as a massive compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
pure business, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an economy about the whole thing. There's a we're going to make this work about the whole thing. Before you know it, you're out of the ball and the beer in the back of the net. And as you say, he's got one goal and one assist, and you're able to sit around and go, well, I'm not sure he was absolutely brilliant. Well, hang on, that is literally the job description.
When we had the four of them, they seemed equally as happy as laying one on for the other lad. I'm sure in Mo Salah's mind now, I think it's got to a point where he's going, I'll win the Golden Boot in my first season here. And I'm starting to feel like, you know, you see him take the occasional penalty, you know, a 2-3 now, and he's, that's in his mind. He wants to. If he beats Harry Kane this season to that Golden Boot, that is some achievement. But you can just see, you know, with Firmino, and you can see it with Mane and even Coutinho to a sense, there's a sense of happiness. Oh, look at what we've done. We'll go and do our dance together or whatever. It's brilliant for the future of the club.
Just on the future of the club, then the significance of the result given the other matches, Manchester United dropping points against Newcastle was terrific to see.
Good old Rafa.
Good game of football as well, actually. I loved the two or three late goal mouth scrambles. If you didn't see it, there was some classic old style goal mouth scramble action, which really, really entertained me. And you could hear the crowd giving it the big one when it got cleared, because there was some clearances that were like goals.
I think Lejeune blocks one or something, and you can hear as they boot it away, they celebrated it like a goal. You don't see that much anymore. It was brilliant.
It was great. Obviously great for Liverpool, and it's always nice when Man United don't win anyway, full stop. And also you've seen Arsenal drop points and realistically put themselves out of the running for a top four finish, Neil, just quite quickly really. We've talked about our record against markedly weaker opposition on the road this season. We have had some sloppy draws, but we've got 11 games to go, and only nine of them are against, only two of them, so there's a remaining nine that are against our rivals. I mean, I'm not saying we're absolutely in the box seat for this, not quite yet, but we can't have asked any more of ourselves. We put ourselves as close to in there as we can do, certainly given the results prior to the Tottenham game at Wembley.
Yeah, definitely. We always get the betting through after every round of games. So, you know, halfway through the round of games, we'll get top four odds off the various bookmakers, and Liverpool are right in there, second to only to United, taking City out of the equation, obviously. So, you look at the problems Chelsea have got there under pressure. They're playing tonight, should win, but then played Bournemouth last week and lost. So, all of a sudden, Chelsea are under pressure. All of a sudden, you can write Arsenal off. Arsenal going, they've got to go.
A title winning form.
They're not going to do that. They've got to go all out for the Europa League, haven't they, Arsenal? They've got to put all their eggs in that basket. Tottenham, they've got Juventus, got a two-legged tie with Juventus. They've never been anywhere in the Champions League, really. So if they were to get to the quarterfinals of the Champions League, would Tottenham be able to resist and prioritise a league game for next season's Champions League if they've got a Champions League quarterfinal already at Wembley? So I still think they've got issues to face. I don't think United are very good. I really don't think United are a very good team, so I don't see why they should be nailed into the top four, only that they've got Mourinho and they've spent a lot of money on Sanchez. I still think they're a pretty average team, as Newcastle showed yesterday. So Liverpool got as good a chance as anyone. Liverpool can finish second comfortably, in my opinion, and they, you know, they've got to go to United, I think March the 10th, they've got to go to United. So go there. Why couldn't Liverpool go and win at Old Trafford and put them under pressure? Never mind Liverpool being worrying about top four. Why not Chelsea, United, and Tottenham?
And the point of being in the top four, Fouad, is that you get your European campaign. We go to Porto this week, and the first thing that strikes me is this is a million miles away from a straightforward game, I think, for Liverpool, because Porto have got tons of European experience. They get around this phase every single year. They know what it is. And the other thing to watch out for are the good players who are used to getting results as well. But I think the last thing on all of this is they're also able to play Liverpool in the way that best suits getting results. So if we go to Bayern Munich, the expectation is that the Bayern Munich players will be on top. They'll have the ball, they'll run the game, and Liverpool go as the underdogs. Porto are able to play here as, you know what, we'll act like we're second best. Act is the key word, because we think we can get ourselves a result.
Yeah, and I think they're actually unbeaten in the Portuguese league, from what I remember. And so obviously a quality side, and I think they're definitely not going to be an easy kind of walk through. So this game just yesterday, I think it's sort of the perfect performance and I guess style of play you want before a big European tie, because I don't think we kind of used up that much energy. We weren't full throttle, full out attack, though there was a lot of sort of counter-attacking, compact shape sort of play. So I think if we anything, as long as we go there and we can come away with a victory in any shape or form, I think sets it up perfectly at Anfield.
Yeah, I haven't done my homework yet, so I don't know how they got on this weekend.
They won 4-0.
It doesn't change what I'm about to say then. They've conceded 10 goals in the league this season, Porto, but they conceded 11 in the Champions League group stages, which to me suggests that they're not getting tested in the league, and that when they do face a better quality of opposition, they're not quite at the level. Mm. And you see Bayern Munich, when they get to the business end of the Champions League, I think they sometimes struggle when teams are actually good and actually have a go at them, and they've been walking through the Bundesliga for a year. Mm-hmm. So I think Liverpool can potentially get this game won on Wednesday night, get this tie one, sorry, on Wednesday night, they can win any tie 3-4-0 away. I think it's about how they approach the game and how long it takes them to figure the game out, because I think they'll start from a basis of respect for Porto and, okay, we're away from home, a draw is not a terrible result in any shape. But if they figure that out in 10 minutes, that actually, you know what, these aren't that good. This Abubakar that they're talking about, he's not actually going to worry us. They don't have a lot in midfield, or they have a few weaknesses of fullback or whatever, the attacking fullbacks. So if they can work that out in 10 minutes, I honestly think Liverpool could win this tie comfortably in the first leg almost and have a nice one. But it's whether they're able to play the occasion the way that they need to.
I think that's spot on. If you look at Porto's kind of league form, they've won 9 out of 10 games, so you'd think, wow, they're going to be some force. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think Besiktas went there in the Champions League and beat them on their own.
They were losing a game as well recently, and it was abandoned because of crowd safety. They were about to lose their unbeaten record at half time. Well,
yeah, I think you're right. I mean, top of the leagues, so you've got to give them respect. I totally agree. But I don't think they'll have faced anything quite like our forward line. If he does go with the traditional front three, it'd be interesting to see what Klopp does with the team. He's obviously got a decision to make around what he does with the midfield, because Emre Can's not going to be in it. Now, is Lallana at kind of peak fitness where he could come in and play 60, 70 minutes? I think I'd like to see him in there if he was, but there's been question marks around his fitness over recent weeks. So it's going to be really, really interesting. But I agree with you, Neil. Liverpool kind of almost playing the occasion, because I think in terms of ability-wise, from what I've seen of Porto, yes, they're a good side, but I absolutely think this Liverpool team could go there and potentially wrap it up. And then that knock-on effect that then, if you can have a really, really strong result, it plays into what you do with those league games, certainly against Newcastle, which I think is the game just before we play Porto at home. And maybe he's afforded to kind of go full strength in that game as well, because those league games against West Ham and Newcastle, you know, you can see a scenario where you go into United Old Trafford, and if you win there, you're going above them in the league, which makes that huge. So if we could go there and kind of win by a couple of goals, which feels like a big ask, but it's not out of the question with this team, then it could be huge going into that second leg.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about what they've got. Well, they've got to be very wary of what we've got. You know, you talk about Abubakar. Well, is Salah, is Roberto Firmino, who scored, what did he score, eight goals in the group stages, or, you know, he scored 8 Champions League goals so far. I think the point you make on whether they're being tested in the league is true of a lot of sides in Europe. We spoke about on the European show on Tall Player about Bayern Munich are often the main example, but they're now they're winning the league now by miles. But earlier on in the season, they felt like they were being tested by the emergence of the likes of Leipzig and Hoffenheim, Leverkusen are back, Dortmund are still a decent side, but also the Italian side, you know, Napoli in Serie A. You look at Roma, what they're going to do at Chelsea. So these sides are now being tested more frequently domestically than they have done in the past. I don't really think that's happening in the Portuguese league. Sporting Lisbon aren't really the side that they have been. Benfica lost their manager to Sporting Lisbon. Yeah,
lost all 6 in the group stage, I think, Benfica, yeah, as well, didn't they?
You know, they sold their best player probably to Manchester City in the summer, and that was the goalkeeper. The lad that they've put in goal is really young, is making a few errors. So I think the Portuguese league is sort of finding itself again. It's one of them leagues where a lot of people have been, you know, you're talking about one of the stars of the league. Well, West Ham with Roman Nanar, and whether William Carvalho is good enough to come and play for West Ham, you know. So I think if Liverpool turn up, you know, Porto go out around this time, because this is when they tend to go and face a big boy. Or, you know, they might get into the last 16 because they're the second best side in the group that might have the likes of Carabag or whatever in. So they do tend to get to this point most seasons. But then if they come up against any opposition, they go out. And I honestly can't see anything better as long as Liverpool turn up in Portugal.
I love the confidence. I'm not quite as confident as any of you. I can see it being really quite a cagey affair, and Porto deliberately keeping it cagey and just thinking we you know, the one that's in my head is actually the Benfica
2006,
where nothing happens in the first leg and you sort of get the impression Benitez half takes it, but then I think they get the late goal to make it 1-0, and you think, oh, well, we'll have these back at Anfield.
There's some out.
And then they get 2 against us, and the whole thing becomes very, very frustrating. Anyway, just quick prediction from you, Ian.
I will go 2-0 to Liverpool.
2-0, Neil?
Yeah, I'm going 2-0 as well.
2-0, Paul?
4-0 Liverpool.
Wow. Good lord.
I'm really confident.
Too bad.
I think 3-1.
3-1 for the Reds. Everyone's gone with the Reds. All right, I'm going to balance this one out for one time. I'm actually going to say the 1-1 draw.
Get out.
Get them back to Anfield. Sorry. Anyway, thank you so much to Neil, to Ian, to Fuad, and to Paul, and you for listening as well to this. This has been the Anfield Wrap, brought to you in association with Reds Bet. Take it easy, everyone. Sports Social Podcast Network.